Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm Friday welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, Transnet moves against rogue suppliers as the port's cleanup gathers pace. Could someone else's bad driving leave you off the road under the new demerit system? Health leaders are searching for a practical route to coverage that South Africa can actually afford, and calls are growing for an independent probe into the country's GBV command center. It's Friday, the 10th of July. South Africa's ports remain one of the biggest constraints on economic growth, but Transnet says progress is being made. This week, Transnet port terminals successfully moving to blacklist seven companies implicated in fraud, bribery and corruption following forensic investigations, while disciplinary action continues against employees accused of colluding with suppliers. I'm going to talk now to Jabu Mdaki, who is chief executive of Transnet port terminals. Jabu, a very warm welcome to you. As I've referenced, several companies now blacklisted. How much damage did their actions cause to port terminals and its customers?
The damage that has been caused cannot be quantified. But if I were to give you an example, we are dealing with a situation where you had a corrupt network within our organization that was colluding with the external companies to allocate work. It brings into question then whether as an organization were we paying for the work that was delivered or the quality of the work that we would have expected, judging from what we have found during this investigation. So the damage to the organization is huge. It also contributed to the persistent reliability of the equipment that we were experiencing, because these were engineering companies that were supporting us on a technical basis.
And these irregularities, as I understand it, allegedly went on for years. It says something, doesn't it, about the controls that were supposed to prevent this in the first place?
Jeremy, I agree with you, but I think one will be amiss not to state, you can have the best controls in the world, but if the people that are going to manage or safeguard those controls are corrupt, then those controls will come to nothing. We need to ensure that we've got ethical people that will uphold the controls that we have in place.
You're also taking action, as I understand it, against employees. Jabu, is this a case of a few bad actors, or do you think it points to a deeper cultural problem within parts of the organization?
Jeremy, let me state from the start, from the onset, that we have a large number of employees within Transnet Port Terminals that are committed and loyal to the organization. And in fact, they have contributed to us uncovering this level of corruption by persistently doing the whistleblowing, raising concerns, and bringing to our attention some of the irregularities that they were noticing. So we have bad apples within the organization that were not acting in the best of the organization. But I'm happy to advise that to date, in our fight against fraud, corruption, and theft, we have dismissed 45 employees and managers across TPT. Two others resigned while we're busy with the investigations, but that did not prevent us from also pursuing them in terms of going after the pensions and other benefits. So those are ongoing, and there's still more that we're going after.
Can you confidently say at this point that corruption and collusion are no longer actively undermining operations in ports?
No, Jeremy, unfortunately not. As I am speaking now, We've got a new batch of other companies that we are evaluating, and that we are basically assessing whether what the action should be taken against them. Some companies we have already placed on notice of our intention to do the same. But the culture, with the actions that we are taking, the culture is changing. As we started taking action against the employees, one could start seeing a shift within the organization as well, where people were now starting to get confidence in reporting and bringing forward irregularities, corruption or corrupt activities, and theft that they were observing within the organization. Knowing confidently that we will act as an organization, we are committed to eliminating fraud, corruption and theft within Transnet port terminals.
Jabu Mdaki, on a slightly broader canvas, while I've got you on the phone, if one were to speak to exporters, many will still complain they would have concern about delays, congestion and unpredictability. Under your watch, what would you say has been the biggest operational improvement so far?
Jeremy, right now we operate 15 terminals across South Africa. I think all of us in South Africa know of the congestion and the crisis that we had in 2023, where we had a huge congestion of vessels outside Durban. I am happy to report that the congestion of vessels and the vessels delays are a thing of the past. Especially in Durban, we now have vessels that are betting on arrival. In the Eastern Cape, if we do have vessels delays, it will be contributed by weather. But again, which can be supported by the shipping lines, when the weather clears, our productivity levels are such that we are able to catch up very quickly to ensure that those vessels are worked on and depart on time or as quickly as possible. So that has been a huge improvement on the container side. We also operate the auto terminals. And as many in the media will be aware, and hopefully the South African citizens as well, we've been celebrating new records that we've been setting in terms of our auto terminals that we are handling, especially in Durban, which has contributed, of course, to the South African economy. Mm. You have a terminal that is 520,000 units that can be handled in a year. But we managed through our efficiencies to push that terminal to handle just under 700,000 units. We also have seen what we are doing in the bulk space, especially with the project that was in trouble or in distress in Saldanha, where you had a tipler that started long ago. In June, we were celebrating a new milestone where we're starting with the hot commissioning of that tipler project and that Saldanha expansion infrastructure project. There is a lot of positives that we can
take. Yet against that backdrop, and you're painting a very positive picture, you will be aware that South Africa's ports, particularly Cape Town, continue to rank poorly internationally. Do you believe those rankings fairly reflect what is happening on the ground, or do you think they're missing the progress that is being made, as you've outlined to me?
Jeremy, I'll be the first one to acknowledge that there is improvements that are required. But the World Bank rankings, unfortunately, do not reflect a true situation in Cape Town. If, for example, the one were to go according to the latest rankings that have been released by the World Bank, they are talking to 2025. 2025 was one of our good years in Cape Town. The only challenge that we started experiencing was towards the end of the year, specifically in November, December, and January, where we had excessive weather delays in terms of high winds and all of that, well, coupled with some of the operational challenges that we had. But I do not believe that if those were to be taken into account, they should be putting Cape Town where it is. We've raised our concerns with the World Bank. We've raised our concerns with the methodology that is used. We've raised our concern with the fact that it does not take into account all the activities that are associated with the port operations. So, no, we do not believe that it is a true reflection of our ports and terminals.
Jabu Mdaki, thank you very much indeed, the Chief Executive of Transnet Port Terminals.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The Arto rollout, as you well know, is continuing, but questions around readiness, fairness, and enforcement are not going away. Now, as I understand it, the demerit system is meant to change driver behavior and make roads safer. We should welcome that. But motorists are also asking a very practical question. Could someone else's offense end up costing me my license? Well, let's get a little more detail on the rollout. I'm in conversation now with Mondi Mkalipi, who speaks for the Road Traffic Infringement Agency. Mondi, a very warm welcome. And just very bluntly here, can someone else's bad driving cost me demerit points?
It's only your driving that will really cost you demerit points, that will cause you to be allocated with demerit points, Jeremy, in the sense that if you operate a vehicle and perhaps you commit an infringement on the road and then you admit guilt. Admission of guilt takes many ways. Going to pay to resolve that particular infringement, it means only admitting guilt, and then demerit points will be allocated. So that is how it is going to work. Well, demerit points, they differ depending on the severity of an infringement. So how it works is that if perhaps you commit an infringement, go through a red light, and then you get fined, demerit points, 4 demerit points are allocated to you, and then those are likely to build up. The more infringement you commit on the road, the more demerit points are going to be allocated to you. And then once they reach the 15th demerit point, that is the cutoff point. If you exceed that threshold point, touching on the 16th demerit point and above, that your not driving license is going to be suspended. And then the system also works backwards in the sense that the more compliant you are with traffic laws, the lesser demerit points you are likely to have, meaning they are going to be deducted, they are going to be reduced. I should also make it clear, Jeremy, from the onset that the way we are going to apply the system in South Africa is that we are going to start from zero, not in the way the other countries do it. That is, give you a certain number of points and then you get deducted. So they get to be accumulated. The 15th demerit point, you get onto the 16th one, the suspension happens twice. If you go over the threshold 2 times, and then on the 3rd time that you go through over and above the 15th demerit point, that's when your driving license is going to be disqualified from driving on our roads up until you have gone through successfully a driver rehabilitation program. It's only then that you'll be allowed to restart and get a new driving license.
I just want to circle back very quickly to my original question. If my car is driven by a family member, an employee, or a mechanic, who carries the penalty, and what would a vehicle owner need to do to prove that they were not the driver?
Well, what happens if you've got a fleet of vehicles, let's say you own taxis, Jeremy, and then these taxis are registered in your name and someone else, you have employed someone else to drive the vehicle, and then that person happens to commit an infringement, let's say gets a camera ticket. That ticket is obviously going to come to you as the owner. And how the system works is that once it arrives to you as the owner, ARTO has got a way in which you are enabled to redirect the ticket to your employee, the person that you have employed to operate your taxi. And then when that person receives the ticket, he or she will also go through the normal ARTO process in terms of the ARTO elective options. He or she can request to pay the 50% discount within the first 32 days, or request to pay in installments. After the payment has been made, demerit points were allocated to that person, not you as the owner, because you have a system that is enabled through the legislation that you redirect the ticket to the person who was operating the vehicle at the time the infringement was committed.
I've got to ask you this question. Do you think the system is simple enough for ordinary motorists to understand?
Well, some say it is a bit cumbersome, and I think the responsibility and the huge obligation is on us as the Road Traffic Infringement Agency or authority to make sure that we communicate and we simplify the process as much as possible. And we also set up systems that are also going to make it work, because now we're going to have a national contravention register. And the National Contravention Register, that is where all the infringements are going to be loaded. And it is also incumbent on each and every road user, on each and every motorist, that every time he or she goes to renew their driving licenses or license disc annually, they update their details. And also they get to check if they've got any infringements that are outstanding, or if they've got any demerit points that are busy accumulating against their names. So it's quite important that we ourselves as road users, as motorists, keep on checking, because even with us as the Road Traffic Infringement Agency, we do have information points where road users can go and get more information on how this is.
Mondi, the reality is, and you know this as well as I do, is that motorists are not going to do that. We're not going to check up on our own behavior.
Yeah, you know how it works. Previously with the Criminal Procedure Act, I mean, that was kind of like happening, because people wouldn't go and check their traffic fines, because the expectation was that those would go to court, and they never went to court anyway. So with ARTO, ARTO has got a very strict timelines where you are provided with all the options to really resolve your traffic fines. The 50% I've spoken about, the right to submit a representation, but if the road user or the motorist fails to take advantage of those elective options that are legislated, the system builds up where we, as the Road Traffic Infringement Agency, send you a courtesy letter to remind you that, well, you committed an infringement and these are your rights. If you still fail to take advantage of those rights, the system shuts you out. We issue what is called an enforcement order. So between a period of 2 months and three months, that's when the enforcement order is likely to be issued. And that becomes very, very difficult for the motorist, because now you can't transact on the notice. You can't renew your driving license. You can't renew your license disc. Even your professional driving permit, you also can't renew it. That's why we think the introduction of ARTO is a game changer, in the sense that nobody is going to sit now and ignore their traffic fines, because the system is going to catch up with you, and then we may have make sure that you account for your actions at the end of the day.
Is it a game changer? That's what you talk about. Is it about road safety, or is it just another big revenue collection machine?
ARTO, Jeremy, at the center of ARTO, it is coming in as a road safety intervention. Because at the end of the day, as you have said in your intro, the system is designed to change the behavior of the road user so that we get to be more compliant with traffic laws. Because if the system catches up with what are called habitual infringers in the sense of the points demerit system, and then road users are blocked from operating on our roads, then at the end of the day, they will have to change their behavior, because if you're running a business, even if you are working for your own family or you any type of a business that involves you to be on the road, you'll have to comply at the end of the day, because the system is going to close you out. You're going to be requested to come forward and account for your actions. It should really make sure that we reduce the number of crashes that occur on the road, leading to the reduction of fatalities that also happen on our roads.
Early days, let's see how all of this pans out. Mondi Mkalipi speaks for the Road Traffic Infringement Agency. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, healthcare leaders are trying to move the universal coverage debate away from slogans and towards, as I understand it, a more practical package of core services that every South African should be able to access, all well and good. The Board of Healthcare Funders says the starting point should be prevention, primary care, essential medicines, and a more realistic conversation, perhaps, about what the country can afford. In that respect, I'm joined now by Dr. Katlego Mothudi, who's the Managing Director of the Board of Healthcare Funders. Katlego, welcome back to the program. As I understand it, is the core service package something completely different or an alternative to NHI, or maybe even a stepping stone towards it? Maybe that's our jump-off point.
Remember, at the moment we have an undefined service package as far as the NHI offering is concerned, but we do have, however, a basis to start thinking from. What we in the private sector, specifically from the medical aid side, we have long contended that what medical schemes offer is not appropriate. However, at the time when this prescribed minimum benefits were contemplated, it was with the view of making sure that whatever is offered does not overburden the public sector. So our starting point is actually an alignment to the principles of universal health coverage. To a large extent, we think what is being offered in the state does align to those principles of preventative and promotive healthcare, although there isn't a big emphasis on it. The first big tranche would be to align the private sector's offering.
Let's talk about the alignment in just a moment, but is your argument not predicated on who decides what is essential healthcare and fundamentally who gets it?
I don't think there's an argument there. There's already guidance, firstly from the WHO, and there are countries that are already offering that. Secondly, as I said, from the public side, we adopted the district health model, which a lot of it is actually in the primary healthcare space. The only challenge was that this has not really been packaged and costed for offering under universal health coverage. The third point is that the private sector has to align itself if we want to see ourselves as a significant player or as a partner to government in terms of NHI, whatever form it may take. We have to be aligned, and that is the starting point for us.
How difficult is that alignment going to be?
There are going to be challenges. I've already mentioned the issue of the prescribed minimum benefits. You may not be aware that, firstly, the regulations stipulate that prescribed minimum benefits should have been reviewed every 2 years. That only happened once, and that's more than 20 years ago. The current process to review them date, I think, almost 8-9 years. And that also shows you the complexity. But we do feel, however, that there are other ways of looking at it, because schemes have now, especially those that are associated with us, been looking at how to augment the service offering to include the preventative and promotive elements of care. One other area that we've been tracking, Jeremy, is where people are spending money on. The Council for Medical Scheme reports annually on what we deem to be the out-of-pocket expenditure. Last year's figure was above 40 billion rand. And if we analyze what people voluntarily spend money on, we will also have an indication of where the gaps are. We have also looked at not specifying the services that are deemed to be relevant to the public in a specific way. I think there has been a leaning more towards a diagnostic definition of a package of services rather than the actual service of consultation. And to that effect, we have looked at rather offering a medicine benefit that would cover a lot of illnesses instead of specifically saying this disease and that disease should form part of the package.
Are you concerned about the prescribed minimum benefit debate, given that it's part of the affordability problem? Is there a different way in which you can approach this and also convince the medical schemes?
We are very concerned. I mean, the actuaries tell us that the budgeting process for schemes immediately recognizes that about 60% of your budget is going towards go towards prescribed minimum benefits. What it actually cost a beneficiary to belong to a scheme is about 1,600 rand per month. So if you've got a family of three, you're already about 4,000 rand off on the most basic budget. So from an affordability perspective, it does concern us. We are also told that if we were to relook at how this was constructed, I think in 1998-1999, we probably would not be able to afford about half of the diseases that are listed in that, and that would be a reduction in access. So it's something that we think going forward will not be affordable, because it reduces the capacity of any entity or scheme to actually increase the basket of services to focus on the primary care component.
Which does suggest, surely, that tariff reform can't happen without doctors, hospitals and funders not protecting their own interests.
It is. I think we do have to recognize that while we want to protect healthcare from being commodified, practitioners do run businesses. they have their own needs. So there has to be a consideration for the income of these entities. However, we believe that the lag that we have in government taking responsibility in establishing tariffs has had a big impact on progression in that regard. And that's one area that we have to start looking at seriously again.
So what's the timeline here?
Well, we have already been promoting some package. We have been promoting the adoption of the essential medicine list for the past 2 to 3 years. So on our part, in terms of making a proposal, it should not take longer than a few months. The challenge is the take up and adoption might take a bit longer because of exactly what you spoke about now. How do you place that alongside the prescribed minimum benefit? Mm-hmm. Now, we could suggest alongside that a change in regulations in terms of approach, but I suspect that there might be not necessarily a pushback, but maybe a lag in adoption because government had already embarked on a process of reviewing the prescribed minimum benefit packages.
It'll be very interesting to see how this plays out. Dr. Katlego Mothudi, thank you very much indeed. He's the Managing Director of the Board of Healthcare Funders.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa has some of the world's most progressive laws and policies aimed at tackling gender-based violence. Yet the country continues to experience alarmingly high levels of abuse against women and children. Now, the Tears Foundation, it's a women-led non-profit organization that provides access to crisis intervention, advocacy, counseling and prevention education, is calling for an independent investigation into the Gender-Based Violence Command Center. It argues that only a small percentage of the calls it receives are ultimately classified as verified GBV cases. So let's put this issue on the table. The general manager of the foundation, Celeste Lowe, a very warm welcome. You're calling for this independent investigation. What's the single biggest concern then that is driving your call?
Thank you so much for having me. I think the thing that is worrying us the most is that survivors on the ground are still being failed. And we owe survivors more than good intentions. We owe them systems that work, services that are accountable, and decisions that are guided by reliable evidence rather than assumption. And so what is concerning us is that we actually don't know how effective the GBV Command Center is.
The department's own figures, as I understand it, suggest only a small percentage of calls are verified as GBV cases. So, Celeste, does this mean the center is failing wholesale, or is it simply being used for purposes perhaps that it was never designed for?
I think there's numerous complications around that, because if I want to just give an example, we have a national call line. Right, we have a hotline. We call it the Hope Line because we sell hope and healing. And on a daily basis, we are getting in between 160 and 170 requests for assistance nationally. And out of that, we have an 80% confirmed GBV cases. So you can see why I'm confused. And I think that there's a problem with how we're collecting data. How are we training operators? How much is this all costing? Is this effective? We can't answer any of those questions. And that brings up the problem of the NSP Pillar 6, which is about research, monitoring, evaluation, and information management. And clearly that is failing completely.
I read that the command center receives hundreds of calls a day. Is there specific evidence, Celeste, that suggests those calls are not translating into meaningful support for survivors? Have you interrogated that issue thoroughly as a foundation?
There's no evidence of anything because they're not publishing anything. They're not saying what's happening. So as you can see, if you do the research, you can't tell what's coming out of there because nothing is coming out of there. There's no reporting back. There's no transparency about what's going on. You can't figure out how much that center is costing to run because there's no figures. There's nothing. We know there's a GBV command center. We know that they're having problems. We know that what started as a really good initiative that was doing really well has been watered down into a very different thing completely to what it started as. So we know all of those things, but we don't have evidence, because that's why we're asking for an investigation, and because there's no evidence.
And Celeste, the consequence of this perceived inaction by the command center is what?
Well, survivors on the ground are being failed, and that they're being failed in so many areas, but in this area as well, because you can imagine now you're trying to phone this number. We don't know, is the phone being answered? Are they being referred? If they're being referred, are those services working? We've got this whole silo situation. It's the same as police statistics. So the system is failing survivors everywhere, because people are not working together. We don't have a unified approach. And that is why one of our other calls is for a unified body that is independent and reports directly to Parliament and ring fence Treasury money for it. Because obviously what we're doing isn't working, and just doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result is ridiculous.
What response have you had to your call for an independent investigation?
The only response that we've had is from the media.
So what's your next move?
Well, we'll carry on pushing. We will, you know, we are asking for things. And I think this is one of the cultures in South Africa, is that if you are an NGO and you are saying something isn't working, you're seen as being combative. No, we aren't combative. We work with services all the time. We work with the police, the NPA, all of these service providers all the time. But when we're saying we can see there's a problem, we want to collaboratively fix the problem. That is our duty. That is our constitutionally mandated role, is to be the voice of civil society. So we want to see the GBV Command Center working. That's what we want.
Celeste Lowe, General Manager of the Tears Foundation, thank you very much indeed. And that is our program for today, and in fact the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday, and we are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.